Are there some people here that are kind of new to Krishna consciousness? Because I need to gauge how I speak to accommodate the audience here. Anyone kind of new? Okay. How about you two? Huh?
We're visitors.
You're visitors. Okay. Are you from Phoenix?
Yes. We're from the Mesa Community College students.
Oh. And the students are studying what?
It's a world religions class.
World religion class.
But we all try to hear it to them. It just started today.
Okay. Welcome. I'll try to speak, at least in the beginning. Once we're down the runway and taking off, I'll just keep going. But we'll start with Bhagavad Gita. They're familiar with Bhagavad Gita? Not yet. Okay. Not yet. Okay. This is ABC of the teachings, the science of self-realization as presented by Krishna, who's pictured on the cover. He spoke the science of self-realization or Bhagavad Gita to his dear friend Arjuna. And trying to consider how to keep things relatable to connect with what I wanted to speak about. So this Bhagavad Gita is part of a big epic, the history of Greater India. Big epic, I mean big. 100,000 verses. This is 700 verses. And it's towards the middle. And the first part of this big epic is describing lineages of kings who, according to Mahabharata, they weren't just ruling some little subcontinent of India, they were ruling the world. And they were sub-kings under a big emperor. That's the picture of Mahabharata. And so many things happened, but one of the things that happened was there was a succession of kings based upon the birth of the eldest son. And there was some issue about the eldest son in that line, or one of the elder sons in that line was born blind. And according to the system that they were following, a blind son can't become king. So the second son born was to become king, and he became king. And his sons, who were born first, were to inherit the throne. But the blind king's sons were, you know, they were the bad guys. Like a good and evil struggle. And they were the evil guys. Because they tried in multiple ways to murder their cousins so they could get the throne. Intrigue. Murder plots, scheming, conniving. Multiple times, in multiple ways. And so many things happened. Very exciting. But at a certain point in time, they were to assume the sons of the second king, who died when shortly after they were born. That's another part of the detail of this intriguing story. They were to assume the throne, but their cousin brothers wouldn't permit that. There was an attempt to create peace. Krishna came with a peace mission. He was even better than Neville Chamberlain. And it was rejected. No peace in our time. It was the cousin brothers said, we cannot live on the same planet. with those other five brothers. There must be war. So as the war was about to take place, the battle, all the parties were lined up. Huge array of vast armies. And one of those five brothers named Arjuna requested Krishna to draw his chariot into the middle of the two armies so he could see who's who on which sides. And that's how Bhagavad Gita begins. All of that is leading up to this little part of this big history. So in the middle of the big history is a jewel, a diamond, where Arjuna gives his reasons why, I can't fight, because. He gives five seemingly very good reasons. Non-violent, good reasons. Good reasons. But he's still not certain, so he turns to his dear friend Krishna and says, I don't know. What's my duty? Can you please instruct me? So Krishna begins instructing Bhagavad Gita in chapter 2. So now we're roaring into Bhagavad Gita already. And the first thing, I'm going to paraphrase in simple language, Krishna is indicating, before we speak about what your duty, let's speak about who you are. And he begins describing the nature of the self as spiritual entity, different than the covering, like the body, the gross one, and even the subtle one, mind, intelligence, and false ego, subtle body, discussed in chapter 7 later. So, but we're this undying, ever-existing, unchangeable, immutable spark of life that's animating the dead matter that looks like what life is. But when that spark of life leaves, the dead matter is dead matter. It disintegrates back into its elemental form. So Arjun, let's understand first of all that you're a spiritual spark, a spiritual entity. And, very important, in order to fully realize, that's a nice theoretical understanding, in order to fully realize that, you have to pay attention to how you regard the fruits of your work. Because when you work with the sense of I am this body, if that's who you think you are, then what falls into the category of mine? That which is produced from me is mine. That which is produced from the body is mine. So I work, and what's mine is the fruits of my work. Like, you know, the money that I earn and the things that I buy with the money that I earn, and my wife or husband, and from the combination of wife and husband, my children, and my home, my car, and my bank balance, and my stuff. That's mine. I and mine in a material conception. So what's the spiritual conception? If I'm spirit soul, I've got staring at me this mine tendency, along with, you know, the tendency still to think in terms of the body, when it's already been described that's not who you are. So an essential part of the teaching of Bhagavad Gita is to understand how to do the duties of life, because that was Arjuna's question, what is my duty? Perform your duty without attachment to the fruits of what you do. What's that? It's, in Sanskrit language, it's karma, phala, tyag. Tyag means renunciation. Phala means fruit. Excuse me. Yeah, phala means fruit. Like, there's some fruits on the altar. You know, we were driving here, we saw a bunch of orange trees. Those are some fruits. Or apples. Or so the fruits of work is something that most people are very interested in. And the teaching of Bhagavad Gita is how to become detached from the fruits of your work. but continue to do your work. To work in the mode of goodness, that's another teaching of Bhagavad Gita, there's modes of nature, but work in the mode of goodness is where you work, you do what is prescribed for you or enjoined for you in Scripture. Another nice term is theistic conduct, or a nice Sanskrit term is sadachar, proper conduct. Do your duty and offer the fruits of your work to the Supreme by sacrifice. Sacrifice in an English sense means render sacred, or yajna. Offer a sacrifice to the Supreme and offer the fruits to the Supreme. Continue with your duty and offer the fruits to the Supreme and live happily. This is taught in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And as that matures, that detached, offer the fruits to the Supreme type of work, something very nice happens. That is, one becomes interested not only, and less and less so, in things temporary, but one becomes interested in the soul, the eternal soul, an awareness of the soul and the destiny of the soul. What happens for one who lives their life with detached work, with offering the fruits to the Supreme? Well, one thing is the intelligence, the subtle form of intelligence that's interested in spirit strengthens, and thus the interest in the soul, and then ultimately the Supreme Soul from which all souls, and for that matter even all matter, comes, was the source of everything, the inquisitiveness into the source of everything. So studying of sacred writings to understand the answer to that question, and meditate upon, and fix one's consciousness upon the Supreme. Now I've gotten you through chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita. We're one third of the way through, because there's 18 chapters. So at the end of chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, you wanted to know what is your duty? Whatever it is that you do, best of all is perform some type of linking your consciousness with the Supreme. And that is what yoga is. We now have to put a little disclaimer at the bottom of invitations to come to our teachings on Bhakti Yoga, which is from Bhagavad Gita, and say you don't need to bring your yoga mat, and you don't need to bring your leotards, because this is a different type of yoga, but it's yoga. It's linking with the Supreme, because most people know yoga or yoga class is the physical kind. You do asanas and sitting postures and sometimes a few other things, like pranayama, breathing, exercise, and different things. But that's all part of a physical yoga system, or ashtanga yoga system, that takes one eventually, if one follows it through, it takes one to the position of in complete trance, fixing the mind, not on anything material, but upon the form of the Supreme within the heart. Paramatma is the term in Sanskrit, the Lord of the heart. So Bhagavad Gita teaches within this body there's two: us, the tiny living entity, very tiny, and the Supreme living entity, who's simply witnessing and fulfilling the desires of the living entity that's us. I'm trying to keep it simple here. So Krishna then, after saying, Arjuna, of all different duties you can do, by all means be a yogi. Pick something that fixes your consciousness upon the Supreme. And all those systems of yoga, of all of them, one is the best. You can read your Bhagavad Gita when you go home if you like. Last verse of chapter 6. The uttama, topmost form of yoga, is shraddhavan, means with faith. Van means one who possesses. And shraddha means faith. Shraddhavan, Bhajate, yo mam. Bhaj, that word bhaj, is the root word of bhakti, or love and devotion, practical activity of serving the Supreme, taking your senses, bringing your senses to sense objects, it's very explicit, and serving the master of the senses with these senses. That's bhakti. Bhajate yo mam. So then, the middle six chapters, we're roaring right along, we're in the middle six chapters of Bhagavad Gita. How Krishna says to Arjuna, I'm going to explain to you how to do that. How to come to that position where your consciousness is fixed upon me. And your intelligence is always engaged in me. I'm going to explain how you do it. So in explaining how to do it, I'm getting to this topic now. In explaining how to do it, Krishna describes, just like with Karma Yoga, it also applies to Bhakti. Now our topic is Bhakti Yoga. What Krishna said is the topmost at the end of chapter 6. The topmost form of all yoga systems is Bhakti. And how to do it, it has stages. There's principles that apply, but there's stages. And sometimes people engage in activity for God, or they're religious, we'll say, because they want something. They may want, commonly, people want to do good things because they know it's good to do good things. And then there's an expectation also, that is, I'll accrue piety from doing those good things, and with that piety, I'll get pious merit, sukriti, and with that pious merit, I will, in this life, prosper. I'll enjoy nicely, it won't hurt anybody, I'll enjoy nicely, I'll prosper, and after this life, I'll go to the good place, heaven. Common, not this religion, that religion. It's a common conception, it's a principle. So Krishna's teaching is, that's one kind. For now, for those of you that are from India and not from the world religion class, Sakam Bhakti, with material desire. Devotion, I do this, I get that kind of approach to God and godly life. I want a long life. I have a health problem. I have a medical problem. I have a family problem. I got a lot of problems. So I go to God. And I approach God for mitigation of my problems. That's mixed devotion. And then there's another stage, there's nishkam, no material desire. When I go to God, I don't have my requisition slip saying, you have a big warehouse, you can take care of lots of my needs, at least, some of these things, please. So nothing in my hand except the request to serve. Nishkam bhakti. Okay, that's the background. Now what I wanted to speak about was how one can achieve nishkam bhakti. How can one come to the stage of serving God or devotion to God or bringing one's attention to God without any material desire or mission or purpose to be fulfilled? Like a business. I'll be your friend because I do this for you and you do that for me, and that's our friendship. And if one or the other stops performing, there's a little disturbance in the relationship, and maybe even the relationship breaks because, hey, you're not fulfilling the things that you used to fulfill anymore. See you later. I'll find somebody that will. That's the kind of, I have those needs. My needs fulfilled. Friendship. But that's not what real friendship is, nor is it what real love is. And Krishna's teaching that platform of causeless devotion to Krishna. Ahaituki pratiyata yayatma suprasidati. When one comes to that stage, suprasidati, one feels unlimited, boundless happiness. Not the material kind that comes, and then it goes, and even when it comes, it's not what we exactly what the expectation was, and so forth. But happiness that's unlimited and unceasing, that's the happiness of a loving relationship with God. So I wanted to speak about that topic. And because I just used up a bunch of time, what I wanted to do was share with you a little bit from this nice little book, Sri Brahma Samhita. It's a little one, but it's heavy because the knowledge within it is full. And the last five verses, I'll just refer you to it, those of you that may have it in your home. If you don't, it's available online. You go to bbt.com and they have books, e-books. You can just read it online or download it and read it in your home or whatever you want to do. The last five verses address the topic. So I wanted to speak about it, and I'll just ask you to read it instead. I don't want to take too long. But it's important. If you have a copy on the book table back here, fine. So that's another option besides online, read it and buy a book at the back. A classic description from Srimad Bhagavatam. What's Srimad Bhagavatam? Srimad Bhagavatam, if I said Bhagavad Gita's ABC, the preliminary, here's how our founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada described, it's like undergraduate study. And Srimad Bhagavatam is graduate study. It's a nice comparison. It's a more comprehensive description of the messages within Bhagavad Gita using historical references of persons whose lives exemplify the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. So one of those personalities is Dhruva Maharaj. And Dhruva Maharaj, who's Dhruva Maharaj for our world religion students? Dhruva Maharaj, the picture within the whole of this ancient Vedic literature, as far as time is concerned, is time is cyclical. And there's small little cycles, and there's medium cycles, and there's really big ones. And the picture of time as far as creation is concerned, that's also cyclical. Not once upon a time there was nothing, and all of a sudden there was a big explosion, and there's matter flying all over the place. That's not the picture of the Vedas. There's God and His energy, and sometimes He withdraws His material energy while existing in the spiritual position, resting for some time, and then creation, maintenance, withdrawal of the creation, and again resting for some time, and then again creation. So in these cycles of creation, maintenance, and destruction, there's smaller circles, and there's what's called yugas. And during the first created being, I wish I had more time so I could do it in more detail, but anyway, when creation comes into being, there's God, He's the creator, and He generates the first born living being named Lord Brahma, who is the speaker of this little small book I'm making reference to. And Lord Brahma has two main responsibilities. It's to take the impression, like a blueprint, a subtle blueprint called Vishwarupa, the universal form, take the plan of the Supreme Lord for the universe and the ingredients and the intelligence and the creative ability and self-realization and everything that he gave him, and then build it like a chief engineer. But, you know, mechanical engineering, civil engineering, electrical engineering, and all the other engineerings. He's like super professor, Lord Brahma. He knows all these things, and he takes the ingredients and he builds the universe. And it's described step by step how that happens. And he then has a second responsibility, and that is to create living entities according to the karma of the living entities from the previous creation, so that they can be situated in different places. They give them residential places and forms of life. So from him, Lord Brahma, come different prajapatis, or forefathers of mankind, and they produce those offspring. So very, very early in the creation, in the beginning of this universe, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, there's Manu, because along with the creation, it's not whimsical, there's an arrangement to keep it in order. That's what Manu does. Lawgiver of mankind. He has a very important responsibility. And the first of them is Swayambhuva Manu. And Swayambhuva Manu has two sons and three daughters, along with his wife. Two sons, three daughters. One of those sons is Dhruva Maharaj. Is Uttanapada. Uttanapada. Uttanapada has an older brother, Priyavrata. And Priyavrata says, "My dear father, I'm not really interested in becoming an emperor. I'd like to go to the forest and just fix my consciousness upon achieving spiritual perfection. But my younger brother, he's very qualified. Uttanapada is very qualified. Let him become king." So his father said, "All right, you can do that." So Priyavrata went to the forest. Uttanapada became king. And Uttanapada had two wives. That was permitted in Vedic culture. Two queens. And the first of the queens was Suniti, and the second of the queens was Suruchi. Dhruva was the firstborn son, the son of Suniti. But the second queen, being younger and particularly attractive, Uttanapada liked her more. There's a clue. If you're going to have co-wives, don't show partiality. It can cause problems. It caused a problem. So, here's a picture of our founder Acharya. So I'm speaking what he has written in his Srimad Bhagavatam. I'm going to skip this. So this is a painting of Lord Brahma. And from Lord Brahma, here's Priyavrata. Here's Priyavrata, who later is described. His father, Swayambhuva Manu, and Narada Muni, a great sage, and Lord Brahma were requesting Priyavrata to continue the line of lineage behind Swayambhuva Manu. So here's Dhruva, the older of the two boys, and this is his younger, let's say, stepbrother, and his name was Anupam. And here's the co-wife, Suruchi. And I have a nickname for her. I call her Su Nasty. Su, the prefix Su means very. She was very nasty. Because her son was sitting on the lap of the king, Uttanapada, and seeing his stepbrother on his father's lap, Dhruva wanted to climb on his father's lap. And Sunasti, Suruchi, she came and said, get down. You're not going to sit on your father's lap. You're not going to sit on your father's throne. There's only one way that you can do that. You can die, and then you can take birth again from my womb, and then you can sit on your father's lap. Now she's saying this to like a 5-year-old boy. I don't even know if he knows what that means. But he certainly knew that it was nasty. And very pridefully she spoke like this because she knew she could get away with it. The king, Uttanapada, was very attached to her. And if I say something against what she says, well, she may not like it, and then we can't enjoy together. And so he was quiet. Dhruva looked at his father for protection, and his father just remained silent. Dhruva just burst out in tears and ran from the assembly in the royal palace, crying and crying and crying, and he went to go find his mother. That's what little boys do when they have a problem. He looked for Suniti. And he looked and he looked, and she was off in the distance. And when he finally found his mother, she tried to pacify him and asked, why are you crying, Dhruva? Tell me, what happened? And holding back his tears, he explained everything that had just happened and asked him, just turned to his mother and said, what am I to do? And his mother said, well, it's very difficult to say what to do because I'm not appreciated by your father like Suruchi. So I can't go to your father. That's why I'm sitting off here in the distance instead of in the royal palace. Because he just doesn't have the same affection for me that he has for this other wife. So Dhruva is very spirited, chivalrous young boy, a hero type, and says to his mother, well, how can I get a kingdom better than my father? He knows he's to inherit the throne, but his stepmother's just treated him in this nasty way. So I want a kingdom better than my father, and better than my father's father, and better than my father's father's father. How can I get that kingdom? That's called Sakama, by the way, with material desire. Big time desire. So his mother says, I don't know. The only thing I can think of is, if you get the favor of the Supreme Lord, Vishnu, then anything could happen. Dhruva considered and said, very well. Tell me how I can find Vishnu. She said, I'm just a woman. I live in a palace. I don't know how you can find Vishnu. But I hear that sages, they sometimes go to the forest and they do austerities and somehow they find Vishnu. So Dhruva said, very well, I'm going to the forest. Little boy, 5 years old, going to the forest to look for God. So he left. And as he went out into the forest, he found lots of things in the forest. He found trees and wild animals and insects and birds and all kinds of things, but he didn't find Vishnu. Because he didn't know how to find Vishnu, like some of us don't know. But Narada Muni, the great sage Narada Muni, heard that the son of King Uttanapada has left for the forest in a very unhappy, angry, and retaliatory mood. So he went to see if he could find him. And sure enough, Narada Muni found him. And when Narada Muni appeared in front of Dhruva, Dhruva was very happy. He had never met Narada before, but he had heard about Narada. And immediately, Dhruva poured out his heart before Narada Muni and said what he wanted. I want a kingdom. I want a better kingdom than my father's father's father. child, you know. Because his father is Uttanapada, whose father is Swayambhuva Manu, whose father is Lord Brahma. He wants a kingdom better than Lord Brahma. So Narada was testing him. He said, "Oh, Dhruva, this is not how you find Vishnu in an angry, get back mentality. You have to be in the mode of goodness. It's not going to work this way." Dhruva remained silent, just looking. He said, "And besides, it's very difficult. You know, sages, they go into the forest and sometimes for lifetimes, and it's very austere and very dangerous. You sure you want to do this?" He remained silent, just looking at him. He said, "Maybe you should go home. When you grow up, you're a little older, and you can handle the austerities that will be needed, then you can come and look for Vishnu." He gave many other good reasons. Dhruva just looked at him. Finally, Dhruva said, "All of your advice is very good. There's only one problem. I can't follow it. I want a kingdom. I want a kingdom. And you're a great sage, surely. You can tell me how I can find Vishnu, because my mother said Vishnu can, anything can happen if Vishnu of God gives his blessings. So Dhruva, please help me. Help me. And Narada, help me find Vishnu." So Narada considered, this boy is very determined. So he agreed. And Narada gave him a process, several part process, because this is in the very beginning of dawn of creation, during the earliest stages where the process of achieving perfection was through meditation. So he taught him a number of austerities to undergo, to fix his senses, and then to fix his mind, a process of meditation, and he gave him a mantra, very important. Mantra means mind delivering. Man indicates mind, and tra indicates to deliver, as in trayate, to deliver the mind from the material atmosphere and again connected to the spiritual atmosphere. If you want to connect with Vishnu, you have to be part of the spiritual atmosphere. It means you have to let go of the material atmosphere. You can stay here, but you can't be have affinity for being the enjoyer of it. And then he even gave him a residence, a place to go. Recently, some of you, even in the room, were with us. We went to Vrindavan, the holy land of Krishna, and we went to Dhruva Tila in Vrindavan. Did you know that? The place where Dhruva went to do his austerities is in Vrindavan, in a place called Madhuvan in Vrindavan. And there's a hill, and we went up the hill and went to the place where Dhruva sat and did his meditation. So Dhruva was very pleased at receiving the mercy of Narada Muni. Now this part is very important, so listen carefully, I'll refer to it again. Having heard from Narada Muni how to achieve the shelter of Lord Vishnu, he felt enormous gratitude. Because Dhruva could have said, or Narada could have said, "No," or "See you later," or "Come back when you're an adult," or something. But he gave him the means to achieve Vishnu. So he felt in his heart enormous gratitude. Very important. Receiving the association of a saintly person, just as Jai Gursundar said, he's been teaching you this, the importance of sadhu sangha, or association with saintly persons. Dhruva got that association, and he was feeling very grateful to the kindness of Narada. And the process that he gave him was meditating upon the form of the Lord in the heart, just like I was describing a little bit earlier, that process of yoga. And these are some paintings of that form of the Lord in the heart. And after hearing in detail, Dhruva circumambulated Narada three times, and at once he left for Madhuvan in Vrindavan. Shortly after, Narada instructed Dhruva, he went back to the palace because he knew, you could imagine if you're, those of you who are parents, if your five-year-old son leaves home because you insulted him, how would you feel? Terrible. Uttanapada was feeling terrible because I was so attached to Suruji. I didn't say anything. And Dhruva was looking for protection for me, and I said nothing. And so he's gone. And who knows? Wild animals in the forest, who knows if he's even alive, and what a terrible person I am. And he was beating himself up really bad. He couldn't even do his kingly duties. So Narada went to visit the king. And he told him, my dear king, don't lament. Your son is safe. And your son not only is safe, but in a very short time, he will achieve spiritual perfection. And he'll come back to the palace. And in that perfect state, he will liberate you. It's the duty of the father to deliver the son. But he'll become perfect and he'll liberate you. So just hang on. Everything will be all right. Your son is doing very nicely. Don't worry. So the father, the king, Uttanapada, was a little bit pacified. And then Dhruva went to the forest and began the process. He went to Madhuvan and did the process that Narada had given him. But that process was pretty extreme. It's not something we could even think about doing in our present age. As he was meditating upon the Supreme Lord, he was reducing his bodily activity, his eating practices. And month by month, I won't go through because of the time factor, but he ate less and less and less in a period of 1 month. And gradually, his foodstuff was, he took a breath of air every other day. You know, we can't do things like what Dhruva did. But he was able to do it because of his consciousness. It was Satya Yuga. And his consciousness was fixed upon the Supreme. And he was, as he was fixing his mind upon the Supreme, you can see he's chanting this mantra. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Like that, continuously chanting this mantra, fixing his mind upon the Supreme within his heart. Eventually he was just standing on one leg, and the weight, because of his concentrated consciousness, his weight was pushing down on the earth. A big depression was being made in the earth. And within the universe, because of his intense concentration and control of his life airs, the higher planetary systems, the demigod region, they were becoming choked. And so, this is another depiction of what Dhruva was meditating upon within his heart. Again, a form of Paramatma. Another painting or illustration of Paramatma within the core of the heart. The earth, the weight of his body, he became as heavy as God is heavy because his meditation upon him. And then the universal breathing became choked. And so this is a painting of the demigods. They went to the shore of the milk ocean. And that's in this cosmic manifestation. Within this universe, there's a planet where Lord Vishnu resides called Shiradakshayi Vishnu. And he resides in the ocean of milk, or Svetadvip. So they were describing, we can't breathe, we don't know what happened, help. And Lord Vishnu said, don't worry, it's just a little boy, 5 years old. He's doing some austerities, and I'm going to go see him very soon. And everything will be all right, so you can go back to your positions. And then Lord Vishnu, from his spiritual position, descended to the place where Dhruva was doing those austerities on the back of his carrier Garuda, and he stood before Dhruva. What happened? Dhruva was meditating upon the form of Lord Vishnu, and suddenly his meditation broke. And when his meditation broke, he became startled, and he opened his eyes and he looked, and that very same person who was meditating upon within his heart appeared before him. And seeing Lord Vishnu before him, he was in ecstasy. And so he immediately paid his obeisances before the Lord, fell down like a stick before Lord Vishnu. As you can see, there's many artist renderings of this little pastime. Lord Vishnu appearing before Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva offered his obeisances again and again, and then he stood before the Supreme Lord Vishnu, wishing to offer beautiful prayers, but he was so choked up with ecstasy he couldn't speak. So Lord Vishnu reached out his conch shell, here you see, touched the conch shell to the forehead of Dhruva, so that Dhruva could then speak, and he spoke beautiful prayers glorifying Lord Vishnu. So I encourage you to read those beautiful prayers, because they're truly beautiful. And after Dhruva spoke, then Lord Vishnu spoke to him. And Lord Vishnu spoke to him saying, my dear Dhruva, you have pleased me very much. You have come to the stage of pure devotion. That means he went from having desire to having no desire. I'll describe it a little bit. But I know what your initial interest was. Your initial interest was that you would have a kingdom. Well, that kingdom has already been arranged for you. But before you go to that place where that kingdom that you wanted shall be yours, you'll have to go back and become king as the successor of your father, Uttanapada, because that's the rightful way. That is your duty. And then after you rule after your father departs the throne and you take the throne for a long, long, long period of time, then you can come to that abode where you were wishing to have your own kingdom. Here is what Dhruva said when Lord Vishnu spoke like that. Oh my Lord, because I was seeking an opulent material position, I was performing severe types of penance and austerity. Now I have gotten you, who are very difficult for the great demigods, saintly persons and kings to attain. I was searching after a piece of glass, but instead I have found a most valuable jewel. Therefore, I am so satisfied that I do not wish to ask for any benediction from you. But it was too late, because he started his whole program with, I want a kingdom, and I want to get back at my nasty stepmother, Suruchi. And I want a kingdom better than my father's father. So he had this get back spirit and attachment to attaining something material. So after Vishnu said to Dhruva, you have to stay here on earth for a long, long, long period of time and rule the kingdom. You wanted this kingdom, so it's going to be yours. And then you'll attain this other kingdom that you wanted. And after that, Lord Vishnu departed. He mounted on the back of Garuda and disappeared. He said that planet that you will inhabit after you finish ruling, following your father, is the poles, what we know as the pole star, or in the language of the Bhagavatam is Dhruva Loka. So here's the, well, it's kind of fuzzy, but this is the Big Dipper, and the Big Dipper points towards the Pole Star or North Star. Now those of you that know a little bit about astronomy, maybe the Vedic picture of astronomy, it is said in the Vedic picture of astronomy that all the planets in the sky, in the heavens that we see, they move in a orbit around or circumambulating around the North Star or the Pole Star or Dhruva Loka. And the reason for that is, according to Vedic astronomy, that's the abode of Lord Vishnu. And just like we commonly circumambulate around the deity, or when we're worshipping Tulsi, we circumambulate around Tulsi. We keep the right side to the Tulsi or to the deity and circumambulate. So the Vedic cosmology is the North Star is literally very high in the vertical picture of our universe, and other planets are below in the vertical picture, but they're moving in a clockwise orbit circumambulating the North Star or Pole Star. So those of you that may know a little bit about this, Prabhupada very much desired that we have a planetarium, a Vedic planetarium. So the plan is, it's being built. It's going to take a while because it's expensive. But the plans have been made for a planetarium in Mayapur. Mayapur is a place in West Bengal where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared. And there will be a huge, something like, I don't know, 10-story dome hanging from the dome like there's a chandelier here in the middle. So at the top, similarly like a chandelier, will be the North Star, and you know, different floors going up the dome. You'll be able to look out horizontally and see, you know, the Vedic cosmology, the hierarchy or the vertical depiction of where the planets are situated according to the Vedic picture of cosmology. And the topmost one is the place where Dhruva went, and the other planets are going to be literally moving, and they have, you know, some structural models of how to make all that happen. And then around the outside of the dome, there'll be, like, press a button, it'll tell you the story, like technology kinds of things, of how the Vedic picture of cosmology says at this level and this level and this level. There's different planets. So the present level where we are is in the middle, called Bhumandala. And above Bhumandala is Bhuvar, and then Svargaloka, heavenly planets. But above Svargaloka, this is for, not for our world religion class, this is for everybody else. There's four more planetary systems. Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, and Brahmaloka, the place where Lord Brahma lives. And that's the upper seven, and there's a lower seven. So that's going to be depicted in this chandelier in the planetarium. One day you'll be hearing about, you know, how that's progressing. Right now they're just trying to build the building and get all the, how is it going to work, technology figured out. So that the deities of Radha Madhava and the Ashtasakhis and Lord Chaitanya and the Panchatattva, they'll move to that new building, the main, that's the central dome. Big, big, big. So big, it's said you'll be able to see it from Calcutta. That's how tall. And then the side domes, the planetarium. So anyway, I'm going off on a little tangent, but the Pole Star is the place where Lord Vishnu said, Dhruva, you will go there to reside. And then Lord Vishnu returned to his abode. And Dhruva was, on the one hand, very ecstatic. He just had audience with the personality of Godhead. But he was also very, very sad because he could have gone with him except for this stupid desire for getting this kingdom. Although getting the kingdom was his motivation to do what he did. But so he went from that having material desire, serving God to get the fulfillment of his material desire, to this position where he no longer had a material desire. How does that happen? What happens in between having a desire and not having one? There's several things. One I mentioned already, and that is receiving the mercy of a saintly person and feeling great gratitude for that which one has received. Because it's real easy to receive something and, you know, politely say thank you, but not really feel anything. It's an important lesson of life, so I'll spend a little bit of time. Something that I like to do when I go from place to place is I like to take prasad from the deity. And you've arranged for some from here, right? Divyasham. You've arranged? No, you don't need to do it right now. I gave him an empty box so they can take prasad from the deity to the next place that I'm going and distribute prasad from the deity. I like doing that. When I came here, I had some from Radha Govinda Temple in New York. So, one time I was giving prasad to a little boy, well, to like a whole group of people. And so I wanted to give some prasad to a little boy. He just looked at me. I never had that happen before. Just offer something to eat to a little boy and he just looks at you. So I thought maybe he's, you know, I'm intimidating, I'm, you know, something, because he doesn't know me or something like that. He's shy. So I gave prasad to everybody else and I came back to him. And he just looked at me. And so his mother leaned over, said something in his ear, and his hand went out. So I gave him some prasad, some food, some sanctified food. Then I asked his mother, what'd you say? I said, I told him it was offered. And he wouldn't take it if it wasn't offered to Krishna. He just has this, he's fixed. He won't take anything unless it's offered to Krishna. I said, wow. But sometimes it's the other way around. Like completely the other way around. The child, you put something in their hand and they just look at their something in their hand and it goes to their mouth and they don't even look at you. And then the parents say, this is universal, all cultures. The parents say, what do you say? And the child says what he's supposed to say. Thank you. It's like those little toys. You tilt them and they say something. That's it. Thank you. There's no feeling at all. Just like, okay, I'm supposed to be polite. Then parents are supposed to say please and say thank you. All cultures. And there's a China and they do the same thing. Say please and thank you. It's universal. How does a parent teach a child gratitude? I challenge you. Not just the behavior, but the feeling of gratitude. Try it. I'm sure you're trying it. It's challenging. Dhruva felt gratitude. Not just he got something, oh, thank you. But he felt great gratitude. And that gratitude is a seed of love. And when gratitude grows and grows and grows and grows, and grows, matures, and the object of that which one is grateful for is spiritual, that turns into love of God, which displaces the material aspiration of life. It's no small thing. It's very essential to go from having a material desire and approaching God to fulfill the material desire, whatever that might be, and to come to the position where there's no material desire. But you go to God simply with love and wishing to serve Him. Then another element in this description is control of the mind and senses by proper conduct. Now, in this case, Dhruva's austerities, I didn't detail it, they were extreme. But for us, if this isn't Satya Yuga and we don't have the qualifications of Dhruva, but we definitely, according to the teaching of Bhagavad Gita and the teaching of Srimad Bhagavatam, we have to utilize our senses properly, meaning not improperly. And so that governs what we do and what we don't do. That's like the external behavior part. And the internal is even more important because the internal is going to determine the external, especially when there's proper guidance by a qualified person like Narada. So if one has a qualified teacher and receives proper teachings of how to direct your attention to God, and one feels great gratitude for that and follows those directions with a grateful heart. Here's what Prabhupada said in a very simple way. I like this very much. Prabhupada said, for one who has a simple, one who carries or has a simple and grateful heart, he can very easily inherit the kingdom of God or attain the kingdom of God. So, that's this Dhruva Maharaj description of going from, it's a classic one within Srimad Bhagavatam, going from approaching God with many, many material desires and ending up on the other side with being freed from material desires. So again, I invite you, it's a reminder, look at the last five verses of this Sri Brahma Samhita. It's very nice, very instructive on this topic. And just to end, there's a nice verse from Canto 2, Srimad Bhagavatam, that's very important. Nice one to hear again and again and remember and live by. Where Shukadeva Goswami, the speaker of the Bhagavatam, says, Akkama Sarvakamava Mokshakama Udaradi Tivrena Bhakti Yogena Yajeta Purusham Param, which means whatever your position is, you may have no material desire, you may have all material desires, you may have a desire for liberation, moksha kama. What's the best method to fulfill that which you would like? Tivra bhakti, very, very strongly, sincerely perform service to the Supreme Lord. Because He's the Supreme Pure, you become purified. So whatever it is that you wish, whether it's a universe, or, excuse me, a kingdom, or something, a long list of somethings, whatever it is, or you wish liberation, I want out of this crazy madness situation, or the having no material desire, simply wishing to serve God, serve Him, serve Krishna with great devotion. This is our teaching in Bhagavad Gita and elaborated upon in great detail in Srimad Bhagavatam. And there's more to the Dhruva chapter, you can read it. Canto 4. Hare Krishna. Any comments or discussion or questions people would like to ask? You're all satisfied?
Yes.
Oh, you do? Okay.
So when the planet was so the whole world was Indian?
Say it again, please.
The whole world was like Indian?
The whole world was?
The whole planet. Like right now, they have different countries, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Before was the whole country
Indian? Yes. Oh, yeah. The emperor, according to the Vedic version, in Vedic times, the emperor was the emperor of the world, the whole, like all the seven continents, yes. Sounds far out, right? Let me give you some little empirical evidence that supports that. You ready? One coach I know, who's now no longer with us, he left his body, but his name was Sataputta. Sataputta was a PhD graduate from Cornell University in mathematics. But besides mathematics, his brain, in my opinion, was the closest person to a genius that I've met in my life. So one of the things that he received an instruction from Prabhupada to study the fifth canto and the portions of Vishnu Purana and other texts that describe cosmology, make a plan for this planetarium. So he did it. And part of the result of his study was he found pictures of cosmology that were almost identical, at least had elements of identicalness throughout the whole world. You know, Siberia, South Africa, South America, Russia, Southeast Asia, American Indians, Northern Europe. And from his studies, he said, the scholars that found the same thing prior to him doing this investigation, they came up with three possibilities of how that happened. And they didn't like the third, but they ruled out the first two. One of them was, it's just an accident. Not so likely. Second one, the human being is genetically wired to come up with cosmology all over the world the same. Not very likely. And the third is, there was once a kingdom where cosmology picture was all over the world. They don't like that one. But they didn't come up with the fourth plausible explanation. If you're interested in that particular piece of information, it's available online. Maybe they have the book here. Vedic Cosmology and Cosmography by Richard Thompson. That was his name before he was initiated. Disciple of Prabhupada. Vedic Cosmology and Cosmography. Whole chapter just on what I just summarized. With pictures and, you know, texts from their writings showing. Because they had, you know, visual images of cosmology. I could give some more, but there's more. Yes, sir. Dhruva Maharaj what?
Was it Satya-yuga?
It was Satya-yuga, yes. Yes.
So what is the use of aim of Satya-yuga?
What's the use of what?
What is the aim of Satya-yuga?
What is it? How long did people live? How long did it last for? That's your one. Okay. You ready for some numbers? Okay. It's very geometric. This present age is, so the number is 4,320,000,000 years. But let me show you the map. It's really cool. The present age is Kali Yuga. What's the duration of Kali Yuga? 432,000. That's the present age. So far, 5,000 have passed since Krishna departed. And then the next is two of those. And the next is three of those. And the next is four of those. Okay? So 4 + 3 + 2 + 1 = 10. You just multiply 10 times the duration of Kali Yuga and you get how long Satya Yuga is. Excuse me. That's how long Satya Yuga is. And then there's four yugas. You add them up. So 4 billion. That's the total duration of four yuga cycles. Excuse me. That's the duration of the four yuga cycles. So 860,000. 1 million something, and add another 432,000 to that. That's how long Satya Yoga is. Huh? Yes, so the life duration during Satya Yoga was longer. Now the kind of maximum life duration is 100 years. Some people live longer, but 100 years. In the previous yuga, when Krishna was present, in Dwarpa Yuga, add a factor of 10, so 1,000 years. Then 10,000 years, then 100,000 years. Average life duration is Satya Yuga. That's the Vedic picture of time. Okay? Yes.
So what is the Vedic cosmology in terms of the origin of the universe? And
what's the origin of the universe?
And the origin of life.
And the origin of life. I would be glad to answer that question in a longer form, but a shorter form, it won't be very satisfying for you or for me. But as far as life is concerned, again, this picture of cyclical things. So, Bhagavad Gita teaches the soul is eternal. So that's life. And souls are periodically sent into creation, maintained for some time where they're undergoing birth after birth in a cycle of birth and death, and then withdrawal of the creation, and then they're resting within the body of Mahavishnu for an equal period of the creation, which is a long time, in a state of susupti, or dormant consciousness, like anesthetized consciousness. The Sanskrit word is susupti. And then the time creation comes again, and then, as Krishna says in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he sends forth generations of men and demigods. So life is eternal, sometimes manifest, sometimes in an unmanifest condition, but the souls are eternal. They're not second chapter. They're not created at any point in time. There's not new ones coming into being. They're eternal. A finite, uncountable number of living entities. That's what your life comes from. It's eternal. Sometimes in a created, sometimes in an annihilated condition, and undergoing cycles of time. And the process of creation, I gave a 25-hour seminar over the Thanksgiving weekend in Seattle on that topic. It's not a short one. According to the teachings of Brahma Samhita and further the teachings that are explained similar in Srimad Bhagavatam. But in short, the energy of God as the living entities are eternal, matter is also eternal, sometimes in a dormant state, sometimes activated by the injection of souls within the cloud of the material energy called pradhan. And then it becomes like impregnation, it becomes activated. But matter doesn't move without the touch of spirit. So when spirit is injected within the cloud of the material energy called pradhan, it becomes activated and creation begins. But there's steps and steps and multiple steps, and then unfolding of the elements and the unfolding of the universes and the filling up of the universes, and then the withdrawal of those universes. And the time energy is a very important, like not only very important, it's an essential part of creation, and the withdrawal of the time energy brings about dissolution. And that time energy is under the control of guess who? The Supreme Lord. For creation purposes, he extends that time energy. For dissolution purposes, he withdraws that time energy. It's his energy. So I invite you to listen to 25 pleasurable hours of description of the process of creation in detail, if you're interested. And some of the devotees here can tell you how to find that. It's online. In fact, it's with video, with pictures, like this, with images that show the whole thing. Okay. Anything else? Okay, well, thank you all for coming this evening, especially our guests from the World Religion class. Hare Krishna, thank you for coming and joining us. Hare Krishna. Shiva Prabhupada, good luck.